The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
So I'm just going to put into context, since the name of this talk is from Trump Care to Medicare for All, what's next for the movement, really to talk about the last year. I'm, you know, with the assumption that people are in the room who have actually know about what Medicare for All is, but not to assume that everyone here is aware of it. So, I mean, in the last year, people probably remember around this time, there were several bills that were being put forward. You know, from the beginning, Trump and the Republican Party have wanted to get rid of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, as they called it. As, you know, looking at it and saying, we have to get rid of this as a socialized medicine, you know, and from the get-go, that had been something that Trump had talked about. He obviously was joined by people like Paul Ryan, who's the Speaker of the House. Really, I mean, this has been their dream to get rid of any kind of advancement in healthcare. And so last summer was really, I mean, for me, it was a really anxious summer because I'm a nurse, I'm a public sector nurse. With all the different kind of manifestations of the Trump Care bill. People probably remember the repeal and replace, right? And then there was just the repeal bill. And then I think there was the skinny repeal bill. And then the final, I think it was the final one was defeated by, if people remember, McCain, Senator, John McCain ended up, they found out he had cancer and they thought that he was going to be one of their votes in favor of getting rid of the Affordable Care Act, and he came in and actually voted against it. So it was defeated, and I want to say that it was defeated not just because, you know, they couldn't get the votes, but really I think the horrific cuts and what they had in mind for people's future under healthcare was the thing that really drove people to become active against this bill. And so the summer was filled, and we talked about this in Socialist Worker. We interviewed one of the people who was involved. There were sit-ins that happened, and collective actions across the country, both at town hall meetings where Republican, you know, legislators were both questioned and, you know, screamed at for taking away people's last possible. I mean, we're talking about they wanted to get rid of, you know, pre-existing conditions, which meant anybody pre-existing condition in this world is cancer, right? In the United States. So getting rid of any sort of safety net that people might have at all. And then the actions that happened in Washington, D.C. My union was involved in some of them, but we interviewed, you know, one of the activists, Runa Ray. She's actually here, but I don't know if she's in the room right now. She's a physician, and she's with a doctors and with Physicians for a National Health Program. She talked really about how they escalated the plan, and I just want to go through it because I think it's important to look at that when we're talking about what's next for Medicare for All. And she talked about how she had gotten an email about people going to the Capitol. Let me just find the page here. She says, I'll just read a little bit of the interview because I think it's important. Back in mid-June, I got an email for a phone call that was happening to plan for a sit-in and an arrest action being planned for the following week in D.C. to protest the first version of Trump Care that came out. There might have been 8 or 10 people on the call. I thought it would be a small action, but when I showed up, there were about 80 people there, and 40 got arrested, and I was surprised to see them come from all across the country. There were groups from Vermont, Arkansas, New York. And then she talks about how that just escalated over time. So if you're talking about, you know, 4 of these different bills, people probably remember them being rolled out one after the other. They were trying everything they possibly could. And she talks about how, you know, things just got larger and larger. And she said, we didn't know, you know, the interviewer asked about the trajectory for the summer, and she says, we didn't know what to expect. June 28th was the first action that I was involved with, and we defeated the first bill in the Senate. This pattern kept happening. We would have an action challenging the latest version of Trump Care being pushed at the time, and it would fail, or the Republicans would decide not to bring it to a vote because they sensed they couldn't win. Then they would come up with a new version. Eventually, we started calling it the zombie death bill because they kept trying to bring it back from the dead. With each new zombie version of the bill, the same group of people with larger and larger alliances would organize for the next action, sometimes with less than a week to organize. The first action, like I said, the end of June, had about 80 people and 40 were arrested. Less than 2 weeks later, there was another one that was 150 or 160 people involved with about 80 people arrested. And it just escalated to about, she said, almost 500 people towards the end of July. And so I think that that sort of idea of what happened and the fact that you can look at Congress and say, you know, they couldn't get the votes, the Democrats were fighting them, the reality of how the bill was actually pushed and defeated in many ways was about action on the ground, collective action amongst ordinary people with groups like ADAPT, but people from all over the country who came. And that was a huge, I mean, to be honest with you, a sigh of relief for anybody who was looking at it. I know I was relieved when it was defeated, but it was a real victory for our side because of the draconian cuts that this bill was, these various manifestations of this bill were putting forward. It was within this context, really, that with the multiple attempts by the Republicans and Trump to dismantle the ACA, that the idea of Medicare for All or single-payer health care became popular again. And she talks about it, Runa Ray talks about how they began to combine, you know, the idea of not getting rid of the ACA with, you know, the idea that everyone should have health care, Medicare for All. And that became very popular, and it actually brought Medicare for All as an idea back to life in a way that it hasn't been for, you know, since Michael Moore, maybe I'm aging myself, but Michael Moore had a movie, Sicko, that was in the mid-90s that came out that actually was the last sort of wave of activity around single-payer healthcare and the fight for that. So it's pretty amazing that that happened. It also exposed a lot of the weaknesses of the Affordable Care Act, which I'll go through a little bit because, and people may know that, and you should bring up your stories about what's going on under the Affordable Care Act, because I think that is really why there was also a lot of anger amongst people that this bill should actually, something needs to change, and so why people are looking to Medicare for All. You know, the Obama administration's Affordable Care Act brought health care coverage to millions of previously uninsured Americans. And there's certainly good parts of the ACA, such as it includes pre-existing conditions, you can be insured until you're 26 years old, things like that that had not existed before. But it's still within a for-profit healthcare system, because the bottom line for the ACA was really a way to expand the pool of possible insurance subscribers, in particular young adults, by making insurance a requirement, otherwise they would face a fine on your taxes. And, you know, but the reality of the ACA in the United States today is that in 2016, the National Center for Health Statistics said some 28.6 million Americans still remain without health coverage. Even those who have health insurance are often unable to make use of it. They're underinsured. And according to the Commonwealth Fund in 2016, approximately 63 million people reported not getting needed care because of the cost. So, you know, the exchanges and all of that, they're not affordable for people. So a lot of people took the fines, you know, and don't have health care and now are fined on their taxes. Or even when they have the programs, they cannot even get coverage in the bronze, the silver, and the platinum plans. So, and this is despite the fact that the U.S. spends more money per capita than any other industrialized nation, but remains at the bottom of the list for almost every health outcome measure, which is stunning when you think about it. It's just money being thrown out the window. And then, despite the name of the Affordable Care Act, people still do not have the access and are unable to afford the health care, like I said. And at the time, you know, still to today, the insurance companies are pulling out of the ACA-created marketplace to sell policies to those without employer-provided insurance. Some 15,000 enrollees in 20 counties nationwide have no insurance plans at all to choose from in 2018, and those numbers are certain to grow possibly into the many hundreds of thousands. You know, and so when you think about what the Affordable Care Act is, I mean, obviously it's something you want to, and people did during the movement, like I talked about the sit-ins, they defended the Affordable Care Act, but it was also the idea that this is not adequate at all. This is still was a boon for the insurance companies and the health industry overall in the United States, and that as much as the Republicans wanted to talk about this being socialized medicine, it was not. And the plan did come from Obama and from the Democrats, and it was really about the Affordable Care Act being a gift from the Democratic Party to the health insurance companies. And yet another neoliberal restructuring of the healthcare industry at the expense of ordinary working class people for the benefit of the rich and powerful in this country. So is it it's really no shock that people want to have something else. That healthcare, when you look at the polls around Medicare for All, I should explain what it is first of all. Medicare for All or single payer. Single payer is kind of a strange, you have to break that down and explain it, but Medicare for All means that everyone should have access to healthcare. And it's the idea is to replace the current system in which healthcare is administered under a complex and almost often predatory network of private insurance companies with one where all people are enrolled in a single government-administered healthcare program. This isn't universal healthcare. This is a step in the direction. You'd still have, you know, doctors in their private practices, but you would actually have a pool. You know, there wouldn't be multiple insurance companies, there'd be one, right? And you'd pay into that, and it's not difficult to see, and you would have access, right? Everyone would have access. I can get into some of the current legislation that Bernie Sanders has put forward, but it's not any surprise that the polls, that people are in favor of this. In fact, they dropped only a little bit. Like when it was big in the news last summer, 64% of people were actually in favor of Medicare for All. So a majority of people in the United States. Now it's about 56%, so it's a slight majority, but it's still obvious that given all the things I said about the Affordable Care Act, plus the fact that how many people go into bankruptcy due to health expenses, things like that, it's a real drain on people when they have to decide, especially in this economy, between do I pay my health care bill or do I pay my rent? And so the majority still exists, and then amongst 22 to 37 year olds, 69% are in favor of Medicare for All, which is, you know, I think probably might even peak up more now that the victory of the DSA member, Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez in the Bronx and also in Queens, shows that was her number one issue, right, that I saw on her list. And so I think that issue and her running a campaign on that speaks to probably an even larger percentage of people who are younger, which, think about it, people who are younger don't use healthcare typically, right? And so I think that shows something quite amazing about the potential around building a movement. And, you know, potentiality then has to get concrete. There are a lot of things that, you know, obviously are out there, and we should get into some discussion about how to take on the myths about what it would mean to have a single payer or Medicare for All system. One of which is, you know, we can't afford to do that, and really talk about how we can convince people about that, because, you know, there are a lot of, and I think there are more people on board within, you could say, the media and the establishment for Medicare for All, but it's still a difficult argument to make and why we need to be able to convince people about that. So the other stuff around how do we win Medicare for All, like I said, and I should also say within the context of what happened around Trump Care, there were also state-initiated bills, both in New York and in California. Hopefully people who are from those states, I know they're in the room, can talk more about those, but those were also successful. You know, they're on, I think California is going back in. The bill was defeated, but it sounds as if it's going to be brought back up. There were real movements around those bills, so it's not only the popularity of it at a national level, but also at the state level, and obviously in two very large and significant states, and what that would mean for a movement around Medicare for All. I think this is my last, how much time? Okay, so then I'll wrap up with this. This is, you know, how do we actually, you know, how do we win Medicare for All? I think it's useful to pull back and look at what it will take to make Medicare for All a reality. The first dynamic is to understand that We haven't seen anything close to the opposition that will cohere among the health care insurance industry and the ruling class as a whole when a Medicare for All proposal, I mean, Sanders has already put it forward, but, you know, if we push forward with a movement, we haven't seen anything close to what they will actually bring forward. Healthcare accounts for as much as 1/5 of all economic activity in the United States. 17% of the GDP. I think it's second to military spending. It's huge in the amount of money that's made, according to estimates. And there's a considerable amount of wealth at stake in the profits of prescription drug industry, from medical supply and equipment sales, and of course, private insurance. So Medicare for All would allow the government to bargain, and just so people know, Medicare for All would allow the government to bargain with health care companies with an unprecedented leverage and economic scale. And it would be a huge blow to private insurers, even if it doesn't totally eliminate them. And moreover, like Sanders' bill is filled with taxes on the rich and powerful, higher taxes on business, wealth taxes, and more progressive income tax structure, and even a one-time tax on offshore financial holdings. So the opposition to single payer will manifest itself, really, I mean, that's a huge thing to take on. So our movement needs to be equally as significant in weight and power to take on those sorts of economic interests, which is why the two parties have always, they've never actually been for this and never brought any kind of, you know, universal or anything close to healthcare for all in this country, because it's such a big moneymaker. So the opposition to single payer will manifest itself in two general ways. The most blatant will be an extremely well-funded propaganda campaign that claims Medicare for All would produce death panels and financial ruin to every household in America. This is what they did when Michael Moore rolled out his movie Sicko, right? It'll be like Canada, no one will get any kind of health coverage, you'll be in a long line, you know, all these sorts of things about socialism, right? Everyone will have to wait. And you just never get the health care that you actually deserve. The resounding defeat in 2016 of a Colorado ballot initiative that would have changed the state constitution to permit universal coverage for every resident gives a taste of how the economic and political powers, including plenty of Democrats who claim to oppose Trump care last year, would line up against single payer. Likewise, in California and New York, it was Democrats who did the dirty work of the insurance industry to block legislation to move toward a statewide Medicare for All system. And then the second less obvious way opposition will take shape is as the Trojan horse effect, you can call it. It's right now, and since I think there is a good number, it's 70 plus, Democrats who have actually signed on to Bernie Sanders' bill, people like Elizabeth Warren, they have nothing but nice things to say about this bill at this point publicly, but there has been and will be an intense pressure to water down the single-payer legislation, which is what happened when the ACA came in. There was the public option, it then got watered down to the Affordable Care Act. So because of the money interest, it's going to be an enormous campaign, and those are the pressures, just the dynamics of what we can expect. But none of this means the fight for Medicare for All is unwinnable. In fact, Sanders' introduction of this legislation at this political moment, when so many people, and with support beyond himself, at least for now, shows how easily a government-run system that guarantees universal coverage could be embraced by the majority of people. Right now, Sanders is probably the most popular politician in the country. Certainly, he is at the federal level, where his favorability rating being higher than his unfavorability rating is unique. And Sanders stands for a progressive political agenda that has partially filled a massive void in mainstream politics. And so, you know, and the bill isn't perfect. Members of the Physicians for National Health program are critical of the legislation for allowing co-payments for some medical necessities, including drugs and biologics. There are questions about how far-reaching and systematic its funding mechanisms are, and whether 4 years is too long for a rollout. But supporters of Medicare for All have shaped the bill in many important ways. It bars deductibles and most co-pays, fully funds abortions, and covers undocumented immigrants, which right now is a huge thing for for a movement and connecting that to what we saw last weekend with all of the demonstrations against deportations and against splitting of families. So the pressure to reverse these important provisions will be relentless, but the larger the movement and the larger the left within that movement, the more people we will have a bill worth fighting for. With Medicare for All, Sanders, in stark contrast to the Democratic Party leaders, is offering something concrete and popular that would change most people's lives for the better. But Sanders' popularity obviously isn't enough. The most important factor that will determine whether we see such a program in our lifetime is whether the widespread popularity and unprecedented momentum is organized so that they become an active force felt in workplaces, communities, and the media. And there are a lot of ideas about how to do this. I mean, Megan is going to go through what the DSA has been doing, and I have been involved. There was one meeting here in Chicago of a new launch of a Medicare for All Now campaign nationally with backing by my union. But we do, you know, lots of questions. Do we need a national march, which was something that came up last year? Do we need to focus on base building? Do we need different forms of coalitions and activist organizations? The answer to all of the above is yes to all of the above, but the question of strategy and timing will take some time to figure out. Activists around this issue need to recognize that we won't win this battle by continuing to do what we are currently doing, just on a grander scale. Whatever organizing we do, we need to be clear on some things. First, it isn't an inside game. Medicare for All won't be won by concentrating on how many members of Congress we persuade, but how many tens of thousands of people are convinced to take action in various forms for single payer. Our organizing needs to be focused on this fact. We need to figure out how to build networks and organizations that bring a large number of activists who can then make collective decisions about how to reach the next layer of people. One step in this direction would be to broaden our approach to the issue, which needs to center both on how transformative a future Medicare for All system would be, but to highlight the suffering that goes on in the healthcare status quo as the price we pay for not having single payer. So in the public mind, the health insurance industry should be no different than the tobacco industry, right? When you talk about what happens to people's lungs, larynxes, all those sorts of things. We need to create a climate where political health insurance company insurance profits are seen for what they are, and that is blood money. And any politician unwilling to do something about it is treated accordingly. Second, healthcare has to become a central issue for the labor movement. And many people, as you know, now we have the inspiration of the red state rebellions in West Virginia. Now the discussion is around their healthcare bill, right? The PEIA. And so connecting that into the labor movement and a revitalized labor movement, I mean, it's contradictory with Janus, but one of the things that needs to actually come out of this is seeing healthcare as being central to those fights. A lot of strikes, if not the majority of strikes, are done around issues around healthcare, because healthcare just keeps going up and up and up. And so unions have already played a role in mobilizing opposition to Trump's healthcare disaster last summer, though not in the numbers they could have, but Medicare for All could become a main issue for labor. One possibility would be to organize workplace committees to support Medicare for All. This has already been taken shape in National Nurses United, and also another union, New York State Nurses Association, could be built on and serve as a model for other unions. And for healthcare unions in particular, the question of workplace issues and how to take on the healthcare system accessibility come together, creating the basis for a stronger struggle. So for example, we have a comrade in the ISO in Vermont who is about to go on strike on Thursday around issues not only around pay, but you know, the idea of bringing in accessibility and staffing. And I think that could be a place. We were just talking to her about how you bring in Medicare for All. If we had a different kind of system, this isn't how things would be run, right? And so I think that sort of idea of, especially amongst healthcare workers like nurses, who there have been a good number of one-day and two-day and strikes. Those are the kinds of issues that need to be integrated into the economic issues when strikes amongst healthcare workers happen. And we need to think about, in an unprecedented way, how to use union power to win the struggle. in this context, I could see an argument for, you know, a national day of strike action for Medicare for All. You know, that's obviously further down the line, but that's what we're talking about, to really, you talk about people at the point of production shutting it down and showing, you know, you want to get rid of profits, that's how it's going to happen. And so striking for political reasons, or really striking in general, isn't something that, well, is not as common as, it's more common now, is not something the labor movement is very familiar with in recent decades, but the tradition does exist, and also unions are the strongest on Medicare for All, that are the strongest on Medicare for All, are also unions that, with more experience on going on strike recently. And there are many other initiatives being discussed to build wider and active support for Medicare for All, including, sorry, this is the last bit, you know, what I said about with single pay, with the Democratic Socialists, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. I know there have been days of action to do petitioning. I mean, I think we need to expand that out. And there was a debate last year about a national march. You know, and there was some, I know that the DSA had there was some initiative to push for a national march among a certain section of the DSA. I think that was an excellent idea. I know there was fatigue people were talking about from, like, the national marches. There's been obviously not a whole lot of national marches, although around gun violence, look at what the potential is. Look at what just happened last weekend, right? People aren't tired of the national marches around a whole number of issues. You know, I'm not saying the spark is there at this moment for a Medicare for All national march or national actions, but you can think about it because it's a very polarizing issue. And so I'll just conclude in this way that, you know, and those sorts of things give expression to the wider support for Medicare for All. People who aren't at those things can actually see there are people organizing. How do I get involved? I mean, I was quite stunned at how many people came out last weekend. You know, in Chicago we had, the police estimated about 50,000 people. 50 to 60,000 people is 100 degrees out too, and you think about what that would mean. More people hopefully will get involved in the kind of opposition against Trump's attacks on immigrants. So, if you know, that sort of mobilization, building into that, building bases, is a major step forward in projecting the importance of the issue. And then just to wrap up, it's a long way to go before we have built organization that can express the widespread sentiment for Medicare for All, but activists can begin to use the opportunities as they arise to build in that direction. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. My name is Megan. My name is Megan Day. I'm a staff writer at Jacobin Magazine. I'm a member of East Bay Democratic Socialists of America, and I'm not Dustin Guastella, who was supposed to give this talk. Dustin is more handsome than me, but we agree on a lot of these issues. I inherited some of his notes, and then I added some of mine in as well, so it's kind of like a group effort. So you'll be hearing some of his thoughts too. And I just basically want to give. The DSA Medicare for All campaign's perspective on some of these questions, including some of the things that Elizabeth brought up. So first of all, I'll start by saying that Medicare for All is at root a call to abolish class privilege in healthcare and establish a social insurance system. The demand has recently been muddied by Democratic establishment types who have tried to insist on an incrementalist approach. You've seen some of them pop up. What was it? United States of Care was like a universal healthcare access kind of replacement for Medicare for All that was gaining traction for a moment, widely ridiculed. So good job if you were a part of that ridiculing effort. So, you know, this is why the DSA has advocated for a concrete approach, leaving no room for interpretation about what we mean by Medicare for All. So what we have five key demands that we won't budge on, and we will say that it's an insufficient Medicare for All program unless it meets the following. These are comprehensive coverage. That means for all services requiring a medical professional. free at the point of service, which means no fees, no co-pays, no deductibles, no premiums. In the case of, you know, for instance, the Medicare for All bill, which does have co-pays, our response is this is an insufficient bill. We're going to go out there and fight for it anyway, but just so you know, this doesn't actually meet our five key principles. And then the third one is a universal coverage. This means U.S. residents will be covered because the flu doesn't check your green card, so neither should we, right? Mm-hmm. And then we have a just transition for workers, and that means jobs and severance for those affected by the abolition of private insurance. This is important for two reasons. One, health insurance industry does employ a lot of people, a lot of working people. We care about the fate of working people. We don't want to leave these people out high and dry. Another is that we're obviously going to see a popular argument mobilized against us that's going to be used to divide the working class on the basis that we're throwing these people out into the streets. So we need to preempt that from the jump. So it's our job to make it clear that these principles and this agenda are the bedrock of a coherent, independent, working class political movement for Medicare for All. That's what socialists are for. We're here to remind people that this is what it actually means. But it's more than that, too. So beyond naming the scope of the demand, we need to take seriously how challenging this demand in particular is to the ruling class in the United States. Why doesn't the U.S. have some form of comprehensive social health insurance? It's not for lack of trying. Working people have been pushing for this since 1915. In 1943, the Wagner-Murray-Dingell bill, I think I got that right, it's long, with powerful labor behind it, almost made it a reality. And by the middle of the century, the rest of the industrial world had won significant health reform for the working class, but we hadn't. We don't have a social insurance system. Why? Because the American capitalist class emerged from World War II more powerful than ever before, unlike it did in some countries. And in the 1940s, the employer class became determined to crush the rising power of a united working class. Preventing healthcare reform was one of their primary goals to that effect. So the Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, American Hospital Association, and the American Medical Association launched an all-out offensive on socialized medicine. And it was all about, and it remains all about, class power. The ruling class in the United States has made preventing healthcare among their top priorities, and we should have no illusions that they understand the score. Major employers know that the current system chains employees to their jobs. Employer-dictated healthcare helps create a workforce that is less willing to strike, it's less willing to walk off the job, it puts labor unions on the back foot in the compromised position, constantly having to negotiate for better benefits in a private insurance system for our workers instead of focusing on more radical demands like democratizing the workplace. So every corporate executive, financial baron, tech guru, and industry titan knows that if we were to socialize health insurance, their industries could be next. It's like a domino effect, right? So this is really, that is basically the fact that capitalists are so dead set on preventing socialized medicine, starting with its financing in the form of insurance, is a good indicator of why we as socialists should push on it, isn't it? To make a socialist revolution, you need two things. You actually need many things, but I'll start with two things. First, you need the working class majority to understand what's wrong with capitalism and to see the need for its replacement. And second, you need the working class majority to be strong enough to really go toe-to-toe with capital and stand a chance at winning. So when the socialist left thinks about how to choose the campaigns that we should focus our energy on, we should always be asking whether a campaign serves these purposes, building revolutionary consciousness and confidence on the one hand and building material working class power on the other. This is why it's not a contradiction to speak in terms of revolutionary reforms. There are some reforms that position us better to square off with capitalism. And obviously capital knows this, which is why they try to prevent certain reforms, right? And then they actually don't try to prevent other reforms. So to be sure, reformism is when your mission is to sort of tinker with the system and make people's lives better, but not really alter the basic structure of capitalism at the end of the day. And reformists prefer changes that give people a much needed helping hand, but don't really undermine capitalism. And these are to be avoided for reasons that revolutionary socialists have effectively articulated articulated throughout the last century, so I won't go into them. But in our haste to, you know, condemn reformism, it would be short-sighted for us to rule out the revolutionary potential of some reforms. There are kinds of reforms, and it's context specific, and you often have to judge them case by case with as much strategic acumen as you can muster, which is one of the primary tasks of socialists, of course. But there are some reforms that actually shift the balance of power in a dramatic way, even if they don't by themselves demolish all of capitalism in one fell swoop. In the process of fighting for these kinds of reforms and eventually winning them, we broaden the popular political imagination, we raise expectations for the working class, and we give shape and solidity to working class institutions and political formations. That's one of the reasons to fight for them. It's not just to win for them, it's what you learn in the process of fighting. So how can we identify such a reform, right? There are reforms that the neoliberals try to sell to us. There are reforms that progressives think are going to solve all of the problems. And then how do we identify a reform that's worth fighting for as socialists, that's worth putting a lot of our limited resources into? I think that a decommodification is a really important concept to start with. So that word means to take something out of the market, to shield it from the predations of private enterprise, to ban the involvement of corporations whatsoever and give it wholly to the people, to decommodify, to make it not a commodity any longer. It's what socialists want to do with everything, from housing to transportation and beyond. And guess what? Millions of people are demanding that we do that right now. These are not socialists. Millions of people are demanding that we do that right now in 2018 with health insurance. So in record numbers, we see that ordinary working class people want health insurance to be provided by the state to the detriment of insurance CEOs and to the benefit of everyone else. For those of us who see the strategic pursuit of certain reforms as integral to a revolutionary program, single payer is a godsend, pretty much. Single payer healthcare will help millions of people, but then all progressive reforms do that, from a raise in the federal minimum wage to increased funding for food stamps. Single payer isn't smart for the socialist left to focus on because it helps. It's smart because it attacks the core logic of capitalism in a serious way. And that some things that are currently privately controlled, you know, it's that basically it forcefully affirms that the principle that there exist zones that are off limits to capitalism, and that some things that are currently privately controlled should instead be publicly controlled, which will take decisive action and will harm the capitalist class. So there's no compromise position here, no technocratic fix that leaves the working class and the capitalist class better off, right? There will be winners and losers, and for us to win, the capitalists have to lose. In a society which is being increasingly subjected to the whims of the market and its victors, single payer actually gives a bunch of wealthy people and corporations the boot and eliminates their private control over a would-be public good, which is rare. So,
and you've been speaking for about 10 minutes.
Thank you. In the fight for single-payer healthcare, we must point the finger squarely at the top. It's us against them. Teachers, nurses, cashiers, receptionists, students, and retirees against billionaire executives and the profiteers, the middlemen, and the otherwise useless layer of bureaucrats and parasites who are the cause of our problems, and it's them we have to fight. But we can't fight them without an army, and we certainly won't win with simple moral appeals to middle-class liberals and democratic politicians whose main interest is in re-election. We need a truly mass movement to win single-payer healthcare. And even more, we need social power, not just electoral power. And to do that, we need to revive a somewhat dormant tradition, which is programmatic political organization. So the left, for our part, has replaced political organizing with the frantic search for a spark that would reignite the 1960s. A lot of left-wing political advocacy today is reactive, it's defensive, and it's ironically somewhat made for TV or for Twitter and for Facebook. There's a lot of righteous indignation floating around and a lot of viral content made to fit. But we cannot win Medicare for All with celebrity endorsements, stunt activism, and high-profile press conferences. Coalitions built on the spark mentality repeatedly prove unstable, shallow, and fickle, and not up to the task of fighting the capitalist class on its home turf. So we have to resist taking these shortcuts, and we have to instead build a stable and durable coalition around our concrete demands, which are indeed mass demands and our decommodifying demands. And in order to do that, we need to do the hard work of door-to-door, person-to-person, face-to-face organizing across the country systematically. To that end, I'll describe a little bit the program that DSA's Medicare for All campaign has undertaken. DSA Medicare for All canvases feature about usually 10 to 45 DSA members who are clad in Medicare for All shirts, and they have their trifolds in hands, and they make their way often in pairs door to door through a given neighborhood. We have turf sheets, and we have maps, and we have rosters, and we have the whole deal. And we've staged these canvases in 60 plus cities and towns at this point. I was trying to ask someone earlier today if we have had hundreds or thousands of people doing this, and it's hard to say, so you know, it's up in that register. And these people, our DSA activists have knocked tens of thousands of doors at the very least. And I can speak from experience. These conversations are actually pretty incredible. You get doors shut in your face a lot, that's a given. But you also get people for whom this is their number one personal obstacle, who are willing to talk to you about the political valences of their personal struggle. And my favorite question that we ask people on canvases is, what do you think it will take to win? And the typical answer, the shallowest answer, is like, you know, more good politicians, right? And sometimes people will point to me and be like, more people like you, you know? But through conversation, you can sometimes get people to the real answer, the better answer, the true answer, which is that when they refer to themselves, they say, people like me, right? So our goal is thoughtful and engaging conversations. We don't just want people's signatures. We want them to understand the political implications and the significance of the fight for social health insurance, and to see themselves as not just a powerful agent, but a literally necessary component of this fight. And I should add that canvases are not all that the Medicare for All campaign does. Obviously, we do lots of other things. We do rallies, we do protests, we do town halls, we do panels and educational events. But the canvases have had the dual effect of helping us learn how to talk to people about some of this stuff, and just training up our organizers, and also building out our organization. So the kinds of administrative work and organizational work that's required to put on canvas after canvas happens to also be the kind that's required to build up a robust socialist organization, which, like I said, is a political tradition that has been abandoned in recent decades. So through this process, we are hoping to build a collective and united political bloc, but that base cannot be preoccupied and confined to voting and lobbying. That's really important for us. So here I want to draw attention to two moments in recent healthcare politics which illustrate the two roads before us. Today, so the first is, you know, is, let's start with this. So today, many single-payer advocates in states around the country will tell you that they are near to winning single-payer in their home states. And no doubt these efforts have taken a monumental amount of organizing and political courage. I've been a part of one in California with SB 562, and I hope to be again. And no one should snub their nose at such efforts, regardless of what we think the limitations of state single-payer legislation are. But nonetheless, we should take stock of the strategic implications of these efforts and what they mean for the future. The state of Vermont provides one example. During the Democratic push to win and champion Obamacare, many single-payer advocates turned to the states to try to win their preferred policy, and Vermont actually got the furthest. In fact, they had all the votes, and the governor was on their side. And yet, Vermont is no nearer to a single-payer system today than it was in 2011, when the nation's first state-level single-payer bill passed in the state legislature. Why? According to the state's politicos, they couldn't afford it, the timing wasn't right, they didn't have the needed infrastructure, and so on. Get prepared to hear that more. But the real reason is quite simpler. Vermont's single-payer advocates did not have the social power necessary to extract the reform. That is, to go toe-to-toe with capital and industry and the political class that protects them. The masses weren't there, and that's what counts. So contrast this with another recent fight over healthcare, the West Virginia teachers' strike. If you asked West Virginia politicos to pass a law to raise all public employees' wages by to raise all public employees' wages by 5%. In 2017, you would have been laughed out of the Capitol. In fact, a lobbying campaign to win such an expensive wage hike would have likely suffered the same fate as the Vermont bill. Eventually, it could pass on paper, but it would functionally mean next to nothing. The difference is certainly not that West Virginia is a rich state with millions of dollars lying around in its state coffers. No, the difference is that something forced the concession despite all odds, a mass strike of teachers that crippled the government. In the span of weeks, not years, West Virginia teachers extracted far more concessions, expensive concessions, than the slickest and most ambitious series of lobbying and electoral campaigns could ever win. The difference is the social power that the teachers had and the way they used it. And we need that to win Medicare for All. The program that DSA has built is just a start, but to my knowledge, it's the only one in the country that proceeds from this basic assumption, though two basic assumptions, that one, we will not win single payer unless we have millions of people agitated against the insurance industry and the politicians who protect and cater and capitulate to it. And two, we have to have a socialist current showing leadership in this fight, one with an independent and serious analysis of the broader conflict between the working class and the capitalist class writ large. To win single payer, we need to build a social force of people who don't just prefer this policy and wish their representatives would win it for them, but who understand the political significance of it and understand that they themselves hold the cards in their hands, which is what we saw in West Virginia, right? So in conclusion, I will say this. I have a lot of faith in this demand. I have a lot of faith in that we're going to win Medicare for All. I think we could win it in under 10 years. And I'm convinced, furthermore, that this is the key issue for working class politics in the coming period. If we win, it will mean so much more than the achievement of health insurance. It will mean a resounding defeat for the most powerful entrenched ruling class in the world. It will mean the potential for a revitalized labor movement no longer shackled by bargaining to maintain health benefits. It will signal a new era of working class politics for the 21st century, and it will mean the establishment of a piece of real democratic socialism in the United States. And because the stakes are so high, and because this train is leaving the station with or without us, that is, with or without a force that can provide an analysis of the real working class mobilization necessary to actually muscle through this popular demand, we as socialists have to take seriously our obligation to this moment. We have a role to play and we have to step up. In short, we can't sit this one out.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.